Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Marketing Podcast. My name is Moya Okara. I'm a senior marketing specialist who has built marketing functions for brands across the globe. On this podcast, I bring into conversation some of the smartest people in the professional world into honest, jargon-free conversations that will make you, the listener, a smarter strategist. This is a podcast not just for marketers, but for founders, commercial leaders, and operators. My second guest has built a phenomenal career in the world of communications in Silicon Valley and now leads communications at Meta, formerly known as Facebook. She's been my sounding board for years, and I am so delighted I get to share her with you, even just for a little bit. Here is Francesca Uriri. Enjoy.
Francesca is a heavyweight in the world of communications. She is the head of communications, product equity, and DEI at Meta. But before we get into your career, Francesca, because I have so many questions for you, I know that given the role that you play within Meta, given who you are as a Black woman in America, I want to begin this conversation asking something that my therapist always asks me when we start our sessions. I'm sorry, guys, this is TMI. How is your heart? Because I can imagine it must be a tricky time to be a Black woman in the United States of America. And even more so, you are essentially leading comms for DEI. How are you feeling?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. You know, I'm just honored to be here, to be in this space, to exist in this moment, and for you curating this platform. I think we oftentimes doing the work that no one actually sees that is work. So thank you for creating this space and this platform for us. And I'm thrilled to be here. And you know that you're one of my favorite people in the world. I'm great, Moya. I think that anyone who works in the DEI space understands that this didn't just happen. There's something in the Bible that says, like, you watch the weather. There's been a shift. I don't know that there's any sort of like person who works in the DEI or like diversity space or inclusion space or equity space or justice space that this caught by surprise. So I'm great. I think how I see the world is that seasons come, you know, this too will pass. I'm not in a sort of like despondent, sad place. There's a lot to be grateful for. There's a lot that I'm happy about. You cannot quench justice. You cannot quench power of human and lived existence. You cannot extinguish that. You can create hurdles. You can try to stifle it, but you can't extinguish it. So there's a hope in, I'm Christian, so it will pass. It always does. So I'm great. Sorry for that again, long-winded.
I live for long-winded responses. I particularly love that. I love how you framed that as well, because I think sometimes we're much more than the things that happen to us. I think how we respond is so important. And I love how you said you can't extinguish justice. I almost want to pick that up and frame it somewhere so that I look at it every day. And I think that's a perfect outlook to have given the circumstances. Okay, let's dive into your career. You've had an incredible career. I've been very fortunate to have a front row seat on just how you have morphed and moved within industries, between roles. That has been really amazing. For the people who don't know you, let's talk about that a little bit. Talk to us a little bit about your background. Talk to us about the journey to becoming head of communications, product equity, and DEI at Meta.
I think that the first thing I want to say is that for a long time, there wasn't a sort of like conscious, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. Because I think like a lot of times, some people always feel like, okay, she had a 10-year plan or she had a 5-year plan. I never have those things, and I probably would never. But what I have always tried to do is understand what the next step is. What is the next place to go? What is the next thing to do? What is the next thing to be? What is the next shift to make in my spirit? And if it sounds overly spiritual, it is, because I firmly believe that the physical is controlled by the supernatural. And I just trust God a lot. Now, for specifics, because people are going to be like, yes. And I do agree that there's a level of spirituality, but there's also work that I've had to do. I'm always curious and open to learning. 2017, while I was heading up communications for Weber Shand Week, a PR agency, I was heading up their communications practice for East and West Africa. And it was great. It was fantastic. I was, you know, we had a roster of like really high value clients like Motorola, Ericsson. That's how I was living the life. But then after like 2 years, I sensed in my spirit, like, okay, there's push. Because it had become something that I could do in my, and no disrespect, but it had become something I could do in my sleep or with my eyes closed. There was now the thing in my spirit to like, okay, you have to move towards something that stretches you further. Mm. And nobody likes stretching. And I, you know, also want to caveat that. Like a lot of time when we think about growth, we don't remember it will stretch, it will challenge, sometimes it will stress. But you won't break.
You may bend, but you won't break.
You may bend, but you know. So I've always listened to what God is laying on my heart and then taking the steps towards that. For example, that's what happened with Weber Shand Week. And then I moved to Uber. And that has just been the recurrent theme with my career. It hasn't always been easy. I was leading up comms for Uber in sub-Saharan Africa. And then I moved to the States. That wasn't easy. That was brutal. And nobody warns you, like, you know, you're a superstar in sub-Saharan Africa, but like when you come here, it's like, no, you're going to start from the bottom, all the way from the bottom. So if I could sort of crystallize that thought, I've always listened for what is next. And I've taken the steps, whether that's literally applying for the role, whether that's talking to people, whether that's being open to learning new skills or like being challenged. I'm always reading. I'm always taking notes. I have journal. I'm always in the, you know, I want to grow and develop myself. I'm constantly evolving. That has served me well. And so from the outside, it might seem like, oh, she has it. Oh, I don't have like a 2-year plan. I just know like when it's time to move to something or the next season or the next stage, I will move quickly. Yeah.
I love how you say that it's constantly evolving. I was reading something recently about how to not get stressed. And it was a conversation with a founder of a multi-million pound business. And she was asked, do you ever get stressed? Because surely this is a stressful role. And she said, well, actually, no, because she always focuses on where her foot needs to land next. I captured that thought. It reminded me of how you spoke to your career journey, how you don't necessarily have like a mind map of, okay, this is where I want to get to in 5 months or 5 years or 2 years or whatever. It's more about where am I going next and how do I position myself for the next thing, and also listening for that inner voice in your case, because you are a faith-led woman listening to the Holy Spirit. You said something that is a nice segue into the next question around how it's constantly evolving. And I want to capture that thought a bit and speak to how the business landscape is evolving very quickly. I think this is probably the quickest it has ever evolved, with intelligent systems and competition between tools and technologies, amazing things that they can do, and how that is influencing how we conduct business today. What is one trend in communication that you think businesses cannot afford to ignore in 2025?
So I'm going to answer that question differently, because full circle of honesty, I hate trends. I despise trends because they aren't sustainable and sometimes they're fickle. So it's like, what does the market say now? What are we going to do now? It's unsustainable. What I would say is, instead of trends, look at value and what is sustainable. So for example, how does a business want to remain valuable or useful to its target audience? And what does it need to do or be to be that? And that also applies to individuals as well, right? So if we remove sort of like that trend pillar and say, you know, for example, I'm a makeup business and AI is huge now, right? But how does that apply to me? how, like, some people might be like, well, that doesn't apply to me, but it does. Maybe in your booking system, maybe integrate some automated AI functionalities that make it easier for people to book, or have some AI generated questions that make it easier for people to engage with your brand. So for me, instead of trends, I would say stay curious, be adaptable, right? People who, and I hate you sort of using this example of like Blackberries and like Nokia phones, because like we always say things like, oh, they don't really adapt. And you know, they, you know, whatever it was, because again, we don't know the inside details, but you have to be adaptable. You have to be flexible and you have to listen, look at the weather. If it's about to rain, you're going to be prepped for it. You're going to have your rain boots on, your raincoats on, your umbrellas. If it's really sunny, you move accordingly while still maintaining like your brand ethos. And the thing that I want to say to that finally is, don't be afraid to fail. We see too many brands and businesses and even individuals. It's like, okay, everybody's on the AI train, so I'm going to hop on it. You don't necessarily have to hop on it the way company B or brand B is hopping on it. And sometimes you fall flat on your face and sometimes you make the mistakes. But again, being adaptable means that we look at life as a learning process and a learning journey versus like, oh, I have to figure all of this out. So be adaptable, pay attention to what is happening, listen to your market, listen to your consumer, listen to your target audience, and don't be afraid to fail. And lastly, this is, you know, I turned 40 last year, so I'm just really existing in the space of like wisdom and all whatnot. Have fun with it. A lot of the times we're too strong up and there's no joy in the process. And that shows. It shows in whatever people or brands do.
I like that approach, and I like that you sort of touched on the fact that certain things will always be evergreen, right? So, you know, obviously creating an agile strategy that can easily adapt but maintaining your brand ethos. And not feeling like you have to sort of jump on the bandwagon because everyone else is doing it. But it's like, how does this connect for me to my business? And how does it also create value for my consumer? What are the core elements of a strong business communication strategy, would you say, especially now in 2025?
First thing I would say is authenticity. And I know that it's kind of like a bandied word. It's like, oh, authenticity. But like when people hear, see, or engage with your brand, there's something that is authentic. So for example, when we see the Nike ads, there's something that is authentic about whether it's the underdog succeeding, or like this latest campaign with women is like, they say you won't succeed, so succeed. They say you won't do it, so do it. Right. And so that energy, and we know that that's what Nike stands for. When we see a Nike ad or comes, we expect that. So authenticity is important. Adaptability is also great. Sometimes you've known a brand for a certain thing or behaving in a certain way, and then they bust a new move and you're like, okay, that's cute. Works. That works because guess what? There's the movement of like, at one point, it was the millennials, and then it was the Gen Zs, and then it's alphas and betas, like after them. So your target audience, there's constantly this shift that is happening that you have to key into. So I would say authenticity, adaptability, and fun. We remember brands that laugh with us, laugh at themselves, laugh at the world, humor. I feel like the world has gotten increasingly serious. And so I think when people hear humor, they're like, okay, that's a bit much. Every brand can do humor. Every brand should do humor. I don't have like ready examples of brands that have done it well, but I've seen a lot, you know, in the past. So I would say authenticity, adaptability, humor, and of course, like creativity. As well, I like to use the examples of Apple, Nike. I think that those are really creative brands that just, you know, show us that you can have fun with it.
Yeah,
You know, I want to store that authenticity thought a little bit because, as you know, that's my North Star. How do you balance authenticity with strategic messaging and corporate storytelling? So I hear you when you say, you know, every brand can be fun. Every brand should be able to engage and have that relatability element. But how do you balance that with strategic messaging? Like, there's things that you have to communicate. How do you go through the tug and pull of both demands and find some semblance of balance, if at all?
I think that I'm going to disagree even with the premise of a tug and pull. Sometimes we sort of assume that because, for example, if humor is baked into something, that then it's not strategic. Humor itself could be a strategic tool, right? And so, you know, in response to that, who are you? Know yourself as a brand. Know yourself as a business. The brand has to know itself and then express accordingly. So it's not either or. Do we remember sort of like these Nike adverts? Yes, we do. Is that authentic to Nike brand? Absolutely. Is it strategic? Absolutely. I sort of disagree with the premise that it has to be either or, because authenticity itself, when used thoughtfully, intentionally, is a strategic tool. I would say, like, just know the brand, let there be knowledge of the brand. And again, the feeling that, you know, it has to be buttoned up and like stuffy and like, and it's like, breathe. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that, actually. And that's definitely one way of looking at it. And I do think that the way the world works is there is like this seriousness and rigidity that we're starting to approach communications with because we feel that it needs to be buttoned up. You know, that is almost seen as like being strategic, when in actual sense, authenticity, like you said, rightfully can be a strategic tool. What would you say has changed the most in corporate communications over the last 5 years?
Social. It's become more social. And I love it. I think that corporate communication, before, you sort of had these corporate communication, marketing, advertising. You had the straight, like you could use a ruler to like distinguish the line. But now it's blurring up. And it's social first. If you think about even internal comms, for example, people are like, okay, yeah, it's two employees, but your employees are on social media now. They're on Twitter, mini or micro influencers in their own rights. Yeah. And so everybody is social in one way or the other. My mother is always sending me, I love her to bits, but every day I wake up, there are like 10 things from like Facebook and TikTok, and she's forwarding things on WhatsApp. And I'm like, you are 68. What is that? You know, do you understand? So every social has changed the way that we engage. Mm. It has changed the way we process information. It has also collapsed boundaries. Mm. So where before you would have to like read in the newspaper or listen on the radio or see the ad, you're seeing influencers, for example, they're baking, they're working out. This morning I worked out with Grow with Jill. She's, you know, I don't know if you know her, but she's this fantastic fitness person on YouTube. I've never met her before, but she's on YouTube. And like, I feel like when we're working out, I'm like, yes, Jill, go, Jill. But I don't know her personally. And so social has changed the way comms is implemented, and even how we measure it now is completely different. I love it. I think that it works, and it forces us comms folks to be less rigid and like more creative. Because like before, what you'd be like, okay, so the media and policy makers and policy elites and da-da-da, you're like, okay, maybe we should talk to influencers, maybe we should do XYZ. So I love all parts of it.
I like that. I like what you said about how social collapses boundaries.
There are downsides of that. Downsides of that, where people feel. So again, it's like how people feel like, oh, I tweeted at Beyonce, why didn't she respond to me? And you're like, she don't.
You're one fish in a sea of millions.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, for people who are listening in and watching, who really want to understand what it is you do. So you lead communications at the intersection of product equity and DEI. What does that look like in practice?
So I always say, first of all, that I'm a comms girl. Mm-hmm. Well, a woman now, you know, being 40, very good. Is a
girl forever. You're young forever.
And so communications is my superpower. Mm. And so today I might be doing product equity. Tomorrow I might be at the World Bank. Mm. Next tomorrow I could be doing something with a beach resort or whatever. And so for me, the medium stays the same. The sort of like pathways are different. Now, what is my day to day? It means that I lend my skill, this superpower of mine, to help people understand how tech can be used for good or how tech is good. So product equity means that we're creating an equitable platform where all voices and all perspectives and the cognitive diversity that is required to build products. So imagine Facebook, for example. There are many people from different countries and races and everything on Facebook. So it's important that in creating that platform for this varied segments of the population, you also have that with the product creation team. Mm. So my role is to help you see why that's a great thing, why it's important to have that built into our products and our system. So there are two levels. There's the product part where I'm like, hey, you know, we have all of this cognitive diversity with our engineers, our product managers, you know, our product people building a product for you to use. Mm. But then there's also sort of like the systemic part where we're saying, we understand that we exist in a world where there are inequalities, where there's injustice, where there's, you know, all of these things that get in the way of product usage, product understanding, product scaling. And so my work also addresses that because equity is important. Regardless of what is happening in America today, equity is important. Diversity is important. We want to be, we're different people. And people think of diversity sometimes, and I think, you know, that's why America is such a fantastic place. People think of diversity as just racial diversity, but like there are many levels to diversity. There's economic diversity, there's social diversity, there's gender diversity. And even within those buckets, it's sort of like further segmenting. So that's what my work entails. And why it gets challenging sometimes, because again, I want to make sure that there's, you know, people be like, oh my God, that sounds fun. It is fun. But the stressful part is that you have many stakeholders and things that are important to many stakeholders across the world. Something that is important to folks in Japan may not be as important to folks in the UAE. And so how do you bridge that? So a high level of understanding cultural nuance and being respectful again of the cognitive and lived diversity and experiences of different people helps me do the work that I do. And I love it, actually. So
I was going to touch on that because as you mentioned, the different pathways, as you gave examples of different pathways, you know, you use the example of the beach and World Bank, and it could look very different the next day. I was going to ask that. That's actually to me, and I guess it's also from having done comms for as long as I've done comms, that actually sounds like a lot of work because you have to wear different hats at any given time. And then you just introduced a new layer to say you have to also be aware of the nuances and norms across the different levels and layers of diversity. It's not just about countries. It's not just about races. It's not just about ethnicities. Like if you actually take it even more granular within countries, there is diversity of thought, of cultures. So thank you for speaking to that. And thank you for also sharing how you're able to navigate that, because that was going to be my next question. The more you talked, I guess for the next person, it could be exciting, but I was just thinking, oh my goodness, that sounds like a lot.
It's absolutely stressful. And which is why it's hilarious to me when people say things like, oh, she got to be XYZ because of DEI. there's no one I know within the DEI space or the equity space or justice space who first of all, isn't most times the most qualified person to do that work, period. And also, it's not easy work. It's a very difficult work. You have to have, obviously, the skills, but you have to have a gifting for it. You have to be gifted. You have to be interested in people beyond titles, buckets. 100%. You have to be able to look at people as where they are and not force sort of like preconceived notions or ideas of how you think that they should be. So, for example, Moyo, like we're both Nigerian women, but even on this call, we're deeply, deeply different in many ways. In our lived experiences, in the places we live. I know you were in South Africa for a bit. I grew up, you know, on a military base as a child. Like, it's just different. Mm-hmm. It's really hard work. It's challenging sometimes, and it's very emotional as well.
Yeah.
People feel, you know, our identities and lived experiences, they're interwoven together. And so sometimes you might feel like that doesn't matter. It's not that serious.
Mm.
Not here. Everything is that serious. And everything matters as it should. As it really should. So. But I love it. I wouldn't have it otherwise.
Mm. I like that you pinpointed that there's an emotional layer to it. And I guess my next question for you would be, how do you then balance the work that needs to be done against the emotionalness of it all? How are you able to, if at all, if that helps your work in any way? I don't even know that you can put sentiment aside because it is sentimental work. You know, how are you able to balance that in such a way that you're not also burnt out emotionally?
Yeah. Again, like all DEI people, I'm burnt out. First things first, because the volume of work that you do is insane. There's no person in the equity or justice space who's going to be like, oh, da-da-da. It's, yeah, first thing. So let's get that out of the way. Secondly, I want to also like debunk. So I don't think there's a difference between emotional and sentimental. Because we think of sentimental as soft. Sometimes it isn't. In fact, most times it isn't. It's gritty. It's, you know how, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine years ago, you know, I was saying things around, you know, how men should be more vulnerable and this. And he was like, but why do you think vulnerability has to present as soft? Why? And that was such an aha moment for me because I was like, yeah, where did I learn that? So a lot of people think that work within the equity, inclusion, and diversity space is like, la da da, oh, I can't you, this like Oprah Earth Mother. It's not. It actually isn't. In responding to your question, I don't think it's a thing of balance. So I'm not separating anything. I'm coming to you as I am. My father was in the Nigerian Navy. I traveled around the world. I live with different people. I'm coming to every situation with that. You are coming with whatever lived and professional experiences you have. And so our work in life and humanity is to then say, okay, where is not even the middle ground? How do we put everything in this melting pot? And why is that important? It's less about, oh, my emotions. And I also want to debunk a little bit. Emotions are important because they tell you something, whether it's anger, whether it's exhaustion, whether it's joy, whether it's anxiety, whether it's suspicion. It's a trigger for something. That has been my experience, but it's not easy. I want to keep saying that. I want to keep saying that because it's, people think it's just, it's la-di-da, we're going to have this kumbaya. No. No.
Yeah. And I like the concept of integration versus compartmentalization or separation. Like, you bring your whole self to the role. And I guess that's why you also mention it's a gifting. It will demand of you everything that you have to give it because you're, you know, when I think about roles in justice, I see them as almost service. Mm-hmm. It's one of those roles where I feel like it's beyond corporate. I think that it's also a service to humanity. So I like how you frame that. How do you think brands can avoid performative DEI messaging and build real meaningful engagement?
So I want to say something that might be contradictory to my work. I think that capitalism is at odds with real equity and inclusion. It's at odds. Capitalism is like, I want you for your talent. And that's it. Like your productivity. And that productivity gives me profits. So impact is not capitalism's focus. Profit is. And so, which is why you're seeing the dismantling of DEI globally, because it never was about impact. It always is about profit. So in a sense, most organizations are performative. Now, does that now mean that, you know, there's a part in the Bible that says whether it's, you know, the gospel is preached falsely or accurately, the gospel is being preached, you know, something like that. And so we can say organizations are, you know, they're performative, but there's still work to be done. We still demand justice for certain parts of or all parts of our society. There are still minorities who are grappling with systemic biases. Those things will always be there. So whether or not the organizations are performative, that work still needs to be done, and it will be done. It may change names or titles or sort of like the buzz, but it will always, you know, exist. How can an organization stay away from being performative? I think, like, just do the work. Again, this idea that we can't do impact and profit is problematic, because you then see brands like Costco, for example, who are saying, nope, we're sticking to our guns and we're going to do this. Well, guess what? Why? Because they have a diverse clientele base. It's not made up of one ethnic, racial, socioeconomic class. It's everybody. And so if you're creating products for everybody, how then do you say, oh, we're not going to be committed to these things that we've said? So I think it's helping, not helping, because, you know, is for brands to come to the table honest and say, we want profit. And everybody knows that capitalism is profit making. You can still make impact. You should still make impact, because we're going deeper into the world as we grow in the world. And like Gen Zs and Gen Alphas, it's important to those subset of consumers that you take justice and equity and inclusion seriously. So if you feel like, oh, you're not going to do it now, you know how Nigerians say, you go see me down for front. You still meet them in front. And then what happened?
I like that. Okay. I don't think that this conversation will be complete if we don't bring up AI. You know, AI is transforming marketing and communication. Just before this call, I had a session on AI and marketing, and I was essentially watching the facilitator build an entire ad just of prompts that he fed the intelligence system. And we watched a full-on Coca-Cola ad in minutes. So, you know, we can't say that AI isn't here. It is definitely transforming marketing and communication. I know there's various schools of thought around AI and ethics and all the different layers. But how do you think businesses should leverage AI without losing the human touch, especially as it pertains to communications? I know that I utilize AI quite a bit in my work with copywriting, but I'm always having to obviously ensure that the tone of voice, the relatability element, all of this is tweaked into the copy, is merged into the copy. And so it still requires that almost like that human hand holding for it to actually resonate. How should businesses leverage AI without losing that human touch?
I think that you've actually like
answered the question.
Because you see, so as a comms person, I can tell AI copy in seconds.
Yeah.
Like when you read it, you're like, okay, a robot wrote this. You can just tell. And AI, however intelligent it is, it doesn't really understand cultural nuance. And when I say cultural nuance, so it might write something that sounds like, okay, this is going to resonate with like Black Americans. But when Black Americans read it, they're like, something ain't right. Use AI as a tool. Don't forget that human beings, because again, we have the beauty of lived experiences that comes through in copy, in content, in engagement. And so don't lose that. Don't lose that. AI is a great tool. It helps you, you know, time, you save time, it makes you more efficient, but don't sacrifice organic, original, authentic human connection for efficiency.
Yeah.
Again, how do we integrate? There has to be this balance and integration. So I would say, yeah, I would say that. And that's why I laugh sometimes when people say AI is going to take jobs.
It's not.
Because if you are a comms or marketing person and you truly understand like how campaign, so even this campaign that was created by this, you know, facilitator, instructor, there are still going to be human elements that are needed. So for example, if, okay, he created or she created this thing, you know, using like AI prompts and it needs to go live somewhere like in India. Do you think that you're not going to need a marketing director in India to infuse certain elements that the target audience in India will connect to? Or if, for example, you're going to launch it in Warri, for example, what does AI know about, you know, Warri people, Warri lingua, or how it is used precisely?
Yeah,
AI is a tool, but like people, there's a reason why people are flesh and blood.
100%. I completely agree with that. I think AI should not be seen as an entity in and of itself or even a function within an organization. I do believe that it is a very useful tool. It is worth, in whatever role or capacity that you play, that you become conversant with the tool and you learn about prompting, you learn how to utilize it in your own field. However, with replacing human beings, I don't see that happen. I think that there's still a place for, there will always be a place for sociology and understanding human nature and that relatability element that you just can't get a machine to do for you, and nuances and norms and cultural context that is lost when you rely solely on robotics. And just keeping that train of thought for a little bit, are there any new platforms or communication tools that you think that brands and, you know, comms specialists should be experimenting with in their roles?
That's an interesting question, because again, like, I'm cautious of giving sort of like this blanket, use list. This. And I've said this like at the beginning, know yourself as a brand and then know where you need to be. So for example, if we use sort of like platforms, product platforms, contrary to what everybody thinks, not every brand should be on TikTok. And I know people be like, what are you saying? Like, video is the thing. But not every brand needs that level, whatever it is. It doesn't need to be there by itself. So I'll use that, you know, maybe they are on TikTok, for example, but like Hermes, whether Hermes is on TikTok or not, the Birkin babes are doing the work and needs to be done for that brand on that platform. And so I think you have to understand demographics of your brand, your target audience, what sort of conversations you want to have, why it's important, then marshal accordingly. Same thing for AI as well. So for example, somebody who is selling tiger nut juice in Warri, and then you want to use AI, ChatGPT, just like that. No pidgin English. No understanding, say if it's use tiger nuts, take chopped coconut rice. It's just like, okay, what are you doing? You're losing the community that you're supposed to be engaging. So I think there has to be a thoughtful approach, and it shouldn't just be, oh, let's go there because everybody is going there. Some brands, for example, don't need to be on X. Well, especially now that is in cesspits. But, you know, just knowing where you need to be. And adapting accordingly.
I always like to say it's so important to start with your brand Bible. Whenever I build a brand, I always do a thing that has that, you know, I call it my brand Bible, where I almost unpack the brand together. We kind of think through, what is our speak? What is our tone of voice? What are our brand values? What are our brand objectives, I always like to go back to the genesis and the foundation of a brand to assist with making decisions on what are the platforms that are best used or is best fit for this brand type, and who it is that we want to engage with, who we want to speak to. So you're absolutely correct. It's so important. I like when you said people need to have self-awareness, but I think that brands also need to, I like to think of brand as entities in and of themselves. Like, brand needs to know itself too and have that level of self-awareness to know what to jump on, what trends to take on, what trends will be a miss. Who are we speaking to? I always like to go back to the very genesis of why we exist and what is our why? Where do we want to play? Who do we want to speak to? And then use that to sort of create a roadmap as to what we'll take on and what we won't. I really like what you said about, you know, trends being a bit of a fad, you know, it comes and goes. It's really understanding for your own specific use case, who are the people we're speaking to? Where do they live? How do we go meet them in their house, essentially? And how do we want to engage with them? But, you know, I've loved every bit of our conversation. I've loved all of this. I want to take us to I know it's been very serious. We've had a very serious conversation. There's something that I like to do towards the end, which I called a rapid fire fun question. It's just two to three questions, no long-winded responses, so just one sentence at best, and it's lighthearted and engaging. It's just a lighthearted and engaging session. So I'll start with the first question. I'm really eager to get your answer to this one. What's one corporate buzzword you wish would disappear in 2025? Okay, so that brings us to the end of the serious questions. There's something I always like to do towards the tail end of our conversation, which I call the rapid fire fun session. I'll ask you 2 to 3 questions. Okay. And you just have to respond in one sentence or one word. Because I know we're long-winded girlies. We can, if you leave us, we're going to be here for 2 hours just yapping. So my first question for you, and I'm actually really eager to hear your response to this one. What's one corporate buzzword you wish would disappear in 2025?
Circle back.
I had a feeling because it's mine. Let's circle back. It's a very American term, I think.
Yes. It's mine.
Oh, let's circle back.
It's mine. Circle back. Kill it. Behead it. Kill it.
Kill it. Okay. My second question is, if you could give a TED talk on something not related to your field, I have a feeling I know what your answer will be to this one. I'll see. If you could give a TED talk on something you not related to your field, what would it be?
Joy.
Huh. Joy. Okay.
How to experience joy. And I know that's not what you're expecting. I'm trying to explain, like, we meant something, gender, this and that.
I was actually going to say authenticity, because I think you're one of the most authentic people I've ever met in my life, period.
Yeah.
I would love to hear you speak to that.
I just want to do joyful stuff now.
Right. Good. Okay. Yeah. I like that. I'd listen to you speak on joy. That'd be interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. What is one book, podcast or article that's really inspired your approach to communication?
That's a hard one.
Yeah.
I will say none. I read a lot of everything. I read chick flicks. I read Nora Roberts, Daniel Steele, John Maxwell. So I'm like all over the place. And I found that when you read broadly, you pick up stuff. When you listen to different podcasts. So I'm not really a podcast listening person, because like my attention span, just sitting down listening to something, I can't do it. But like TV as well. So if I'm watching The Crown, for example, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. If I'm watching Love and Hip Hop or like WAGS, I'm like, oh, that's cool. So it comes from everywhere. I don't feel like there's just one source.
Oh.
Just because I'm immersing myself in the world so deeply.
That's the perfect response, because I don't know that I have a response to that actually either. And I was like, huh, should there be a book? Should there be should there be a podcast or an article? I can't really name one thing that has really inspired my approach to communication. I think you need to kind of pick from various places and really kind of engage with different kinds of people and norms and nuances as possible for you to do an excellent job. Okay, so that brings us to the very end. I have just one more question for you in closing, which is, you know, for everybody that's joining, marketing or communications professionals, you know, want to level up in 2025. And I know that anyone who's listening to this, even if they're not in marketing and communications, they've definitely taken one or two things today. But what is one piece of advice in parting that you'd like to give to them?
Embrace failure. Probably what I mean to say, do these 10 things or do 7 things. We are too afraid. And I say this to myself as well. Do the interview. They may pick you on, they may, you know, you may get selected or not. Apply for the role. You may get it or not. Travel, you know, do it. Just do it. You might fail, but a lot of us are so afraid of failing that we don't even try. We don't even try. We don't try to learn. We don't try to message the person on LinkedIn. We don't try to, like, embrace failure. Shoot your professional shot or personal, if that's what you want to do. Failure always prevents us from moving forward. A lot of us, because in our heads, we're thinking, like, what if I fail? And so what? Embrace failure. What I was, I know that, again, not a specific thing, but, like, I'm also learning that.
Yeah.
I'm not embrace failure.
Yeah. And I think you're preaching to the choir when you say that. Like, I think it's something that everyone needs to hear, because we have come to your point around how I feel like the world has become very stiff and rigid, and everyone's, you know, now there's cancel culture, and there's people that are scared to say things online, and, you know, people are scared to be opinionated. People are scared to share their opinions and thoughts on things, and everyone is sort of moving on eggshells. And as a result, we've all sort of in many ways become very performative. And with that also becomes like dimming or extinguishing your light and the very thing that makes you you. So it's like, go for it. Whatever it is that you want to achieve in the world, nothing is impossible. Like, with everything becoming so accessible, it just means that you're, you know, the sky is your limit.
And sometimes, you know, I would say, like, for high achieving people, because I tend to be like a type A person. Like, I'm doing,
that's
like
me.
But, like, we're so hamstrung by failing, or, like, not getting it right.
Yeah.
Like, it not being perfect. Let it go. Let it go. The greatest thing that you can do for yourself, and I'm speaking to myself as well, is surrender to just go with the flow. You might you might fail and you might not. And for type A people, 90% of the time you've always succeeded anyway. So what's the 10% or 3% or 2% of failure? Why is that going to sort of like destabilize you so deeply?
I read this article once, just in closing, and it was this lady who said that she had set a goal for herself to fail as many times as possible. I think she was like, every week she gave herself a number, and she was like, okay, I need to fail, say, 7 times this week. And what inherently ended up happening is that she went for all the opportunities that she would naturally have never gone for. And because she was so hyper focused on failing, she actually wound up succeeding. So when she succeeded, it was almost like, okay, that wasn't the goal, but I'll take it. And then I'll keep trying, and I'll keep, with social media and people sharing more, I quite like that there's also a move to people sharing their failures, because it makes you know that even the people that you're looking up to have failed. The people that you're looking up to have also, you know, had somebody tell them no. And it doesn't diminish you in any way. It's being okay with failing. I like that a lot. I'm going to take that one for myself. You know, I just really want to thank you once again for just coming to the party, coming in your whole true self. You know, I loved it when you said, actually, I don't agree with that. And that was the Francesca that I was hoping to meet today, because you are so true and honest in your approach to life and your approach to everything that you do, all your many expressions. So thank you. And is there, do we want to tell people where to find you and your many expressions on LinkedIn, on Instagram?
Yeah, I would say like just so again.
Not you getting shy.
I'm not getting shy because I think like some people, again, you know, like I'm notoriously reclusive. Notoriously so.
It's and so a wonder that I got her to do this, guys.
And so sometimes some people like descend on like my DMs and they're like, this and that. And I'm just like, oh, Jesus. So yeah, I'm on LinkedIn as myself, Francesca Onomara Uri, and I'm on IG as myself as well. Well, Zany Fan on IG. So yeah.
Do you want to talk a bit about Leading Ladies?
Yeah. So thanks for, you know, again, making the space for that. So I always like to say that I have I express in different ways. And so one of the ways that I express is through a nonprofit that I founded called Leading Ladies Africa. And our work is really focused on advancing gender inclusive leadership, equity, and economic justice for African women and girls. And what does that mean? People are like, okay, that sounds great. What does that mean? For us, it's the idea that women have always and will always be leaders. So this idea that, you know, women have to be molded into leadership, it's BS. What they need is opportunity. What they need is access. What they need is capacity building, some of them. And so our nonprofit is, we see ourselves as an accelerator to just help women move into the spaces so that they lead more effectively and there's more wholesome impact. And of course, we do that through programs, through advocacy and communications and content. So please, that one, check us out on all the platforms. We're Leading Ladies Africa on Instagram, on X, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and on TikTok. Okay. So yeah, check us out.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Francesca, for doing this. I know I had to bring you out of your little hermit enclave. So thank you. Thank you for just honoring my invitation. Thank you for lending yourself to this today. I know how busy you are. I know how busy it gets. So I feel very, very honored that you have granted me audience today. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Francesca.
Bye.
Bye.